Well, it's my last chance to bore you this visit. I want to thank everyone involved in the invitation, Father Morgan and Father Weber, and for having treated me so well, the ladies in the back who have kept me well fed and well watered, and a chance, and to all of you, fascinating conversations. I've learned much. The nice thing, you talk to anyone who's been a teacher, and they'll tell you that the real joy of teaching is as you teach, you finally learn things. It's the best way to actually learn. So it's, I've learned much this weekend, and I'm very pleased about it. This will wrap up. I'll be talking about Henry V this afternoon. And what I'm going to try to do, because we've spent the whole weekend looking at the tetralogy, is to put it in context of the preceding three plays. It's very rare you get the opportunity to look at them as a complete cycle, as a whole. They're often done individually, but it is fair to say it's very rare to see them all done at once or done as a sequence, so one can follow the action as it takes place from play to play. And this is where Shakespeare ends the sequence. If, as I believe, he planned it from the beginning, then he knew where he was going and he had a sense as to how it would end. And as I said before, if each of the individual plays is a bit different, Richard II being a tragedy, Henry IV Part I being a historical comedy, Henry IV Part II really being an elegy, then I'm going to talk about Henry V as a kind of epic. It's obviously not an epic. An epic is a very specific literary form, a rare literary form, but there is much about this play that I believe Shakespeare is using to give something of an epic vision. That is, an epic hero who through his actions and through his life is giving a sense of what a nation is about, what a people is about, and what it is they've stood for. Now, he's prepared the way for this in that we've seen the historical sequence and we've seen young Hal develop over time into the king that will now dominate this last play. But oddly enough, I want to make the point from the beginning that while there are epic qualities to the play, in fact, it's pulling in dramatic and theatrical ways in a very different direction. So let me start out this way. I talked about Henry IV Part II having a very curious induction or prologue with Rumor, the allegorical character that came out at the beginning. Shakespeare expands on that in Henry V because there is a chorus. Now, he's had a chorus come out, obviously, in other plays. Romeo and Juliet begins with a chorus. He will use the chorus fairly regularly. But always before, the chorus has just been introductory. In Henry V, the chorus appears before every act. The chorus becomes a major figure throughout the play and a major figure in the design and structure of the play. So that the first thing that happens on the stage is that the chorus comes out before the action begins and gives a very famous speech, very well known, that is oddly an apology. And I just want to make the case that having used Rumor to give us a sense of what he's going to be doing in Henry IV Part II, he uses the chorus that opens Henry V as a guide for us to understand what it is he's going to be showing us in Henry V. And one reason this play is much misunderstood, I'll talk about that in a moment, is people do not grasp, I think, what's going on in the chorus at the beginning where he makes clear to us how we should view the play. You know the speech, let me give it to you. It's a magnificent, magnificent opening to the play. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment. But pardon, gentles all, the flat, unraised spirits that hath dared on this unworthy scaffold to bring forth so great an object. Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or may we cram within this wooden O the very casks that did affright the air at Agincourt? Oh, pardon. Since a crooked figure may attest in little place a million, and let us ciphers to this great account on your imaginary forces work. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now confined two mighty monarchies, whose high upreared and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts. Into a thousand parts divide one man and make imaginary puissance. Think when we talk of horses that you see them printing their proud hoofs in the receiving earth. For 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings, carrying them here and there, jumping o'er times, turning the accomplishment of many years into an hourglass. For the which supply, admit me chorus to this history, who prologue-like, your humble patience pray, gently to hear, kindly to judge our play. Some believe that this prologue is there because Henry V opened the Globe Theater. We know it was opened in about 1599, the year the play was first performed, and some claim that the chorus is there making reference to the actual building of the theater, which Shakespeare rarely does, simply because it was a new theater, and he's pointing out, and he calls it, this wooden O, okay? That's entirely possible. But it seems to me there's a higher purpose to it, which is simply this. What the chorus is talking about is the inadequacy of what we're about to see. It is very odd. An epic always begins with the epic poet calling on the muse to come down and inspire the poet. Shakespeare, obviously thinking something epic-like, invokes the muse in the very first line of the play, but calls for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. The muse has to go from here below up above, and then maybe there could be an adequate presentation of this grand, glorious account of the reign of Henry V. But the chorus is saying, we can't do it. We can't do it. We are inadequate. What you're going to see here is those of us who have dared on this unworthy scaffold to bring forth so great an object. The play is about a yearning, a belief in greatness, a reaching for greatness, an attempt to move upward that always somehow, by being human, is going to prove inadequate. There is more to what we dream and desire and hope than we can ever realize. And indeed, the playwright says as he begins this play is going to be inadequate to the subject. So that what I want to set in your mind is the notion that this is a play about human failings and inadequacies. Now, it's one reason people are incapable, I think, of getting a fix on this play. There are two schools of thought among the critics, basically. One is that this is a hyper-jingoistic drama where Shakespeare was just rattling a saber and showing the glories of war, and presenting Harry, who had been a very complicated figure as Prince Hal, simply becoming a soldier who goes off and wins battles and doesn't have the complexity that he had when he was a young man and was hanging around with Falstaff. They view it really as a propaganda piece and not worthy of Shakespeare's art. Okay? There are others who see it as indeed a picture of the triumph of the English spirit, one of the greatest heroes Shakespeare ever created, the glory of England, and the end result of what's come before, and indeed believe what the chorus at the opening of Act Two says, that what our poet and dramatist is presenting here is indeed, I quote, the mirror of all Christian kings. This is as good as a king can get, and Shakespeare is showing us his greatness. The anti-war crowd finds it a disgusting play, and a dishonest play, that glorifies war. The pro-Henry crowd views it as a glorious representation of the greatest king that Shakespeare ever imagined, and proves it by calling him the mirror of all Christian kings. Now, coming to that phrase, and it does mean what it says, Shakespeare is presenting Henry in a very positive light. But it is a light that is filled with inadequacies, and the very metaphor itself should take us back to Richard II. The mirror reference should make us think of Richard and that shattered mirror where Richard lost any sense of who he was. I think Shakespeare emphasizes that again with the line in the chorus before Act One, which says, "Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts, into 1,000 parts divide one man." In the same way that Richard, looking in the mirror, shattered the mirror and then saw himself, a fragmented modern man in 1,000 parts. What I think we have here is an attempt by a very wise man and a decent ruler who has lived a life and absorbed a lot to take the fragments and try to pull himself together into one integral being who, as king, must lead his nation. Now, let me give an example of that. I'm not going to go through, I could go at length, and I don't want to do all of this, but I'll give you a couple of hints of it. All the way through this play, we are seeing in Henry, or hearing from Henry, memories of those characters from the earlier plays who rise up again and seem to either speak through him or act through him. He is, it's the line from Tennyson's Ulysses, "I am a part of all I have seen," okay? And in a way, King Henry now has pulled together all of these people he knew, who influenced his life, who were important in his life, from whom he learned very valuable lessons, and they are speaking through him in a coherent, balanced way that they themselves never quite achieved. Listen to this speech. This is the opening, most famous speech in the play, the St. Crispin's Day speech, which I'll come back to later. But listen to these lines and tell me who's speaking this. "God's peace, I would not lose so great an honor as one man more methinks would share from me for the best hope I have. Oh, do not wish for more." Back, I started too late. "If it be a sin to covet honor, I am the most offending soul alive. No, faith, my cuz, wish not a man from England, God's peace. I would not lose so great an honor as one." It's Hotspur. It's Hotspur's voice that's coming out of Henry at that moment. This has puzzled some critics, even some of the greatest critics. Let me read to you what Dr. Johnson, the great Dr. Johnson, says about that moment. "I know not why Shakespeare gives the king nearly such a character as he made him formerly ridicule in Percy." Hal ridiculed Hotspur for that kind of talk. Now, Hal as king is talking like Hotspur. What has happened? He has learned something from Hotspur. He has absorbed something from Hotspur. And he can understand honor and the importance of honor and the need for a king to publicly proclaim that honor before his troops he's leading into the Crispin's Day speech. There is a reason for it here. I think it's balanced, but what we're getting is a little bit of that character that we thought we had left behind. It is, if you will, a fragment of time past that has become a part of Henry and that he can give voice to and indeed attempt to live up to. I'm going to give you one more example. This is Act 4, Scene 1. I'll come back to this again, too. He has disguised himself and he's walking about the battlefield talking to his own soldiers. They don't know it's the king. He has a debate with one of the soldiers named Williams. We'll look at it in a minute. But then he has his only soliloquy in the play. And as he soliloquizes, he is talking about the burdens of kingship. He's talking about the ceremony, the great advantages that come with being king, and then says, no, not all these, thrice gorgeous ceremony, not all these, laid in bed majestical can sleep so soundly as the wretched slave, who with a body filled and vacant mind gets him to rest, crammed with distressful bread, never sees horrid night the child of hell, but like a lackey, from the rise to set, sweats in the eye of Phoebus, and all night sleeps in Elysium. However, of course, what watch the king keeps to maintain the peace? He's quoting his father. The words coming out of his mouth come from the soliloquy of Henry IV that opened Act 3 of Part 2. There is something of his father that's been absorbed. And he understands the burden of majesty. And in a way, it's more crucial here, because he's just been accused by one of his soldiers of perhaps leading the men into battle for the wrong reason. This isn't just not being able to sleep because you're feeling guilty and worried. This is a king on the eve of battle who is aware of the burden of being a king and has just been questioned by one of his own soldiers as to whether or not the cause is just. And if it's not just, says Williams, let it be on the king's head. It's a real burden. It's a real burden. There are moments in the play where Henry, now king, plays Falstaffian tricks. There are at least a couple of them that are very, very interesting. The kind of game he played with Falstaff, one of them, the magnificent scene, Act 2, Scene 2, where he has discovered three traitors who have betrayed him for France, just as they're about to embark. And instead of confronting them, we get a trick played on them. The king talks about a man who was drunk, who attacked the king, spoke out openly against the king himself, and says, well, he was drunk, therefore I must forgive him, I must be merciful. And the three traitors say, show no mercy, show no mercy. Whereupon he then hands them their three commissions. They open the commissions and read, they've been nailed, they've been caught, the king knows, and he says to them, don't you dare ask for mercy now. Don't you dare ask for mercy. You just denied mercy to someone who merely was drunk and spoke out of turn. You betrayed the king. Whew. It's a Falstaffian trick. Same way, after the battle, in the little confrontation with Williams, they agree to meet after the battle if they survive. And they have exchanged gauges, little hint of Richard II, the gauges that began all this. Henry says he'll wear it in his hat. He takes that glove and gives it to the Welsh captain, Llewellyn, who doesn't know what's going on, puts it in his hat, and William sees it, and a feud erupts between them. It's very funny. It's quite naughty. A king shouldn't be playing such games, but there is still something of the gamester in him. He doesn't get it out, let it go on too long. He explains it all. He honors Llewellyn. He gives Williams a glove filled with gold coins. So everybody, it turns out well. But there's something of that game playing that's still in him. He learned it from his time with Falstaff, okay? This man is a composite. He's trying to become integral. He knows what a great king should be. He's aiming for it. We're told at the very beginning of the play, and when the action begins, we have two churchmen, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of Ely. And what they're talking about is practical politics. There has been a bill put forward to seize much of the holdings of the church, and they're very upset. So again, this supposedly epic vision of the greatness and glory of the country begins with hard practical politics. And not only that, politics within the church, such a thing couldn't be possible. Okay? Couldn't be possible. And what we've got is the two churchmen trying to figure out how to get the king to support them against these lawmakers who are trying to seize their property. And in their conversation, they talk about the new king. Archbishop of Canterbury, the courses of his youth promised it not, because they've just said the king is full of grace and fair regard and a true lover of the Holy Church. We discover from the beginning he's devout, and we'll see it. It's proven out in some ways in the play. The courses of his youth promised it not. The breath no sooner left his father's body, but that his wildness mortified him, seemed to die too. Yea, at that very moment, consideration like an angel came and whipped the offending Adam out of him, leaving his body as a paradise. Very high praise. They are overwhelmed at what grace has done to transform him out of the wild youth he was into a mature man who seems to be, his body is a paradise. The Bishop of Ely responds. He has a different explanation based on nature. The strawberry grows underneath the nettle, and wholesome berries thrive and ripen best, neighbored by fruit of baser quality. And so the prince obscured his contemplation under the veil of wildness, which no doubt grew like the summer grass, fastest by night, unseen, yet pressive in his faculty. Like the strawberry, surrounded by other wild growth, could grow firmer, better, tougher. That's why the prince surrounded himself with these companions. They're praising him. They have a sense of his goodness. But they're about to go in and manipulate him, because he is considering war with France. Now, I want to make one point before I look at that, the actual beginning of the war. And that is, these images of the fall are everywhere in this play. When Henry confronts the three traitors in Act 2, Scene 2, he's speaking to them and talks of his own disappointment in them, because he believed in them, thought they were friends, held them in high regard. I will weep for thee, for this revolt of thine, methinks, is like another fall of man. And we have a sense all the way through that all of the human beings in this play are fallen. Shakespeare is emphasizing it. It is very odd to have a play on an epic scale with a heroic central figure that simultaneously is presenting to us fallen human nature. But it goes back to that beginning chorus, "Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts." This is about as good as it's going to get, given the fact we're human. But there is something noble, good, upright here. This may be the mirror of all Christian kings, and this may be what you get. Now, I'm back to the beginning. The two churchmen go in to see the king, who is considering claiming the right to the French throne. They are doing it because they want to divert his attention from what's going on in England. He, of course, was told by his father, busy, giddy minds with foreign quarrels. And right away, he's considering a foreign quarrel, taking his father's advice. He is claiming this land. The French say he has no right to it, because he would inherit through a female. And they have claimed, because of the Salic law, the throne, the crown, cannot be passed through the female line. The Archbishop of Canterbury is there to prove otherwise and to prove that the French are lying when they claim this and that they themselves observe the Salic law. And I will tell you, he goes on in a speech that takes forever. I have seen actors die on stage trying to do this speech. It is about 70 lines long of the most astounding historical gibberish you've ever heard. Now, Shakespeare takes it almost exactly from Holinshed. And this was the claim that was made on Henry's behalf. But the poor actor has to stand there and go through it. I'm just going to give you a part of it, because Shakespeare includes one item of his own that I think makes very clear what he's up to at this moment. The Archbishop has already been going on for about 40 lines before I pick up here. But this will give you a sense of what it is. He conveyed himself as heir to the Lady Lingard, daughter to Charlemagne, who was the son to Louis the Emperor, and Louis the son of Charles the Great. Also, King Louis X, who was sole heir to the usurper Capet, could not keep quiet in his conscience, wearing the crown of France, till satisfied that fair Queen Isabel, his grandmother, was lineal of the Lady Ermengarde, daughter to Charles, the aforesaid Duke of Lorraine, by the which marriage the line of Charles the Great was reunited to the crown of France, so that, as clear as is the summer's sun, it's a very funny line. Because the entire speech is convoluted, impossible to follow, historical names being flung about. This is not at all clear. There's nothing here clear at all. But this is the reason why Henry's going to go fight in France. And the king at the end of this speech simply says, "May I with right and conscience make this claim." Archbishop of Canterbury, "The sin upon my head, dread sovereign." This is murky stuff. This is politics. This is hard to sort out. This is human. And has there ever been a war that was absolutely clear and open? And whenever human beings go to war, they like to assert an absolute ideal. What we all know is that the causes are often about this solid. And that's what's happening here as Henry decides to go to war with France. But there's one other thing that provokes him. And that is, he brings in the ambassador to France, who says he's brought a gift from the French Dauphin. A chest is brought in. Henry asks his uncle to open it. "What treasure, uncle?" He opens the chest. It's tennis balls, which is an insult, saying, you're not a real king. You're still just a kid who plays around, aren't you? Go play your games. It's an insult, an incredible insult. Notice, and this is one of those moments, Henry rises to an occasion. "We are glad the Dauphin is so pleasant with us. His present and your pains we thank you for. When we have matched our rackets to these balls, we will in France, by God's grace, play a set, shall strike his father's crown into the hazard. Tell him he hath made a match with such a wrangler that all the courts of France will be disturbed with chases." And he goes on and makes very clear, you don't insult the King of England. And you don't. And indeed, there is an additional cause now, but the whole business of heading off for France to fight, even though what's it going to result in? One of the glorious moments in English history. Peace out our imperfections with your thoughts. Now, Henry's ready to go. I already mentioned the scene with the traitors. He's betrayed by these men he had trusted. Act 2, Scene 1, however, we meet the comic characters again, except somebody's missing. And his absence is felt. Pistol is there. Bardolph is there. There's a new character named Nim. And Nim and Pistol have been fighting over Mistress Quickly, whom they both want to marry. And Pistol wins, he's married her. And Nim is furious. But please notice what we're talking about, once again, the comic parallel that deflates what's going on in the main plot, possession of a woman. We've got an argument about not quite inheritance rights through a woman, but the possession of that which is valuable through the woman, and we get this comic scene. It's not real funny. It's loud. It is distracting. And then all of a sudden, it doesn't go on for too long. Shakespeare is aware, I think, of this. In comes Falstaff's page boy and says, "Mine host, Pistol, you must come to my master and your hostess. He is very sick and would to bed. He's very ill." Hostess quickly says, "By my troth, he'll yield the crow a pudding one of these days. The king has killed his heart. The king has killed his heart." The next scene is Henry complaining about being betrayed by friends. And Shakespeare surrounds it with the death of Falstaff, one of the greatest friendships ever, with Falstaff dying because the king hath killed his heart. And yet before they go off to him, Nim says, "The king is a good king, but it must be as it may. The king is a good king, but it must be as it may." The king is betrayed by his friends. He's outraged. It's a new fall of man, he says. And then we get the death of Falstaff. Off stage, we hear about it. The characters come out extremely sad. And the comic energy, in a way, is not in the play any longer the way it was in the Henry IV plays. "Bardolph, be blithe, Nim, rouse thy vaunting veins, boy, bristle thy courage up, for Falstaff, he is dead, and we must yearn therefore." Bardolph says, "Would I were with him, wheresoever he is, either in heaven or in hell." Mistress quickly, this is one of Shakespeare's great speeches, "Nay, sure, he's not in hell, he's in Arthur's bosom. If ever man went to Arthur's bosom," she means Abraham's bosom, but she's not real bright. She sort of heard the name. And yet in a curious way, where Falstaff does go is he resides in that realm of legend with Arthur here in England forever and ever. So it's somehow, it's one of those mistakes that may be right. "He's in Arthur's bosom. If ever man went to Arthur's bosom, he made a finer end and went away than it had been any Christom child. He parted even just between 12 and 1, even at the turning of the tide. For after I saw him fumble with the sheets and play with flowers and smile upon his fingers, and I knew there was but one way, for his nose was as sharp as a pen, and he babbled a green fields. How now, Sir John," quoth I, "what man, be a good cheer." So he cried out, "God, God, God," 3 or 4 times. Now I, to comfort him, bid him he should not think of God. I hope there was no need to trouble himself with any such thoughts yet. So he bade me lay more clothes on his feet. I put my hand into the bed and felt them, and they were as cold as any stone. Then I felt to his knees, and so upward and upward, and all was as cold as any stone. And the great man leaves us. The incredible irony is that Shakespeare has stolen that description of death from another source. There is somewhere else where someone reaches in and feels from the feet upward, cold, 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 and announces the man has died. It's the death of Socrates in Plato's Phaedo dialogue on the immortality of the soul. It's just staggering. Why he used it here? Is it a comic parallel? Is it a little tribute to the wisdom of this comic? I have no idea, but it's heartbreaking. It's beautiful and heartbreaking, a simply incredible moment. And then they all go off to war. They all go off to war. But we get to France in the play before the English troops arrive. And the French are proud, 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 arrogant, arrogant, and proud. These dirty Englishmen are coming, and they're going to make fools of themselves. And we can whip them in a minute, and it's not going to be a big fight. But who wants to take what, and who wants to lead? Now, it's very funny. When I saw the Kenneth Branagh film, I went with my French sister-in-law. It was sort of embarrassing to see that movie with a very sweet French girl sitting next to you. She didn't say anything. She watched it. We're done. We're coming up the aisle. And she turned to me and she said, I was cheering for the English. The play is arranged that way. The French are so arrogant that once again, Henry and his men seem very human, very down to earth. Off we go to France, and all of a sudden, kaboom, we're at the Battle of Harfleur. And we begin the battle in France in the midst of a battle, very famous lines, once more under the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with our English dead. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger, stiffen the sinews, conjure up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage, lend the eye a terrible aspect, leading the troops on. It's one of the great rousing battle speeches ever made. He finishes it. They run to the breach. They're attacking Harfleur. And in comes Bardolph saying, on, to the breach, to the breach. It's undercut instantly. Instantly. Now, many say it's Shakespeare deflating Henry and showing that there's nothing to all of this courage and what. No. It's balancing it. And indeed, these low comic characters never do go and fight in Harfleur. They decide now they might get killed, so they're hiding out. They never do go to the breach at all. But there's one other thing I would like to point out. There's something fascinating in this speech. It is not become a savage. The speech says imitate the action of a tiger. Disguise fair nature. What you want to do is scare the enemy. That's going to think they're going to be torn apart, and indeed this is what happens in Harfleur. The mayor comes out and Henry gives a horrifying speech in which he says, here's what I'm going to do to the innocents in your city unless you surrender the city to me. And it's quite gruesome. It's fairly clear in Shakespeare's presentation, it is Henry again imitating what a savage would do. The mayor surrenders at once. And indeed, there is no battle, more battle that even takes place. That's not historical. The historical Henry ravaged the city. Shakespeare removes it. There are moments in the play when he elevates the hero. There are times in the play, and we'll see one coming soon, when he makes very clear Henry is compromising who he was and performs some very questionable actions. It's going back and forth. Now, maybe Shakespeare was a little upset at being too hard on the French. So we get a scene in Act 3. This is a good trivia question. Get your friends with this one. In Shakespeare's plays, there is one scene written entirely in German, Spanish, French, or make up another one, okay? Or Italian. They won't believe it. There is a scene here entirely in French. The French Princess Catherine comes out with her waiting gentlewoman, and she's trying to learn English. And all of a sudden, we become very sympathetic to the French. Her waiting woman has spent a little time in England, and so she knows that, well, some of the English are coming, and the English may overrun us, so I guess I should learn a few words. Comment appelez-vous le main en anglais? The main, elle est appelée de hand. De hand. Et les doigts? Les doigts, ma foi, j'ai oublié les doigts. Ah, mais les doigts. Je pense qu'ils sont appelés des fingres. Oui, des fingres. La main, the hand. Les doigts, les fingres. It's very funny. It's, and this mangling of the language goes on until we're running through the whole body and the princess has her waiting woman. What do you call le pied? And the waiting woman says, le foot, which is an obscene French word. And the princess is horrified and says, oh, those English, I can't learn English. What we get again, something very comic, very, very human, but a young female influence has come into the play for the first time. There has been nothing feminine in the play since Richard sent his queen back to France. And we've had Mistress Quickly, we've had Lady Percy, who became a widow and was hardened. We have young femininity now, and it's connected with France, and it's joyful, it's innocent, it's charming, and a new breeze is sweeping into the play, which will move us to the ending of the play, by the way, but he's setting it up here. Curiously, we then go into the English army, and I don't know what's happening here, but in America, the military would be very pleased with this because we have much diversity in the English army. We've got Llewellyn the Welshman. We've got Gower, who's an Englishman. We've got McMorris, who's an Irishman. We've got Captain Jamie, who's a Scotsman. It's real diversity. It's what the armed forces in America is all about now. With this difference, Shakespeare had been around them and understood them. These guys don't get along. And they're fighting and at each other constantly. There is as much fighting going on within the English army as there is in opposition to the French. They have different backgrounds. What's interesting is they have all come to fight for the king. If you'll remember, in the earlier plays, we have rebellions in Scotland, rebellions in Wales, rebellions in Ireland. They've joined together. There is something in this king that has pulled these people together. It is again a sign of something in him that is remarkable, and we'll see how he does it in the great Crispin's Day speech. We're heading into the battle. Act 4, the chorus that opens Act 4. I love this. This is one of my favorite passages that Shakespeare ever wrote. It's the night before the battle. The chorus comes out and says, now entertain conjecture of a time when creeping murmur and the pouring dark fills the wide vessel of the universe. From camp to camp, through the foul womb of night, the hum of either army stilly sounds, that the fixed sentinels almost receive the secret whispers of each other's watch. By the way, that's historical. Before the Battle of Agincourt, the two armies were so close together that it is recorded they could almost hear each other's sentinels speaking. I mean, they were very close together. Fire answers fire, and through their paly flames each battle sees the other's umbered face. Steed and threatens steed, in high and boastful neighs, piercing the knight's dull ear, and from the tents, the armorers accomplishing the knights with busy hammers closing rivets up, give dreadful note of preparation. The country cocks do crow, the clocks do toll, and the third hour of drowsy morning named. Then he goes on to describe the proud and overconfident French, who are sure they're going to win, and are playing at dice to win various English noblemen. This is historical. They were so confident that they were dividing up the spoils and the prisoners before the battle took place. Meanwhile, we have the English camp in terror. Oh, now who will behold the royal captain of this ruined band, walking from watch to watch, from tent to tent, let him cry, praise and glory on his head. For forth he goes and visits all his host, bids them good morrow with a modest smile, and calls them brothers, friends, and countrymen. Upon his royal face there is no note how dread an army hath enrounded him, nor doth he dedicate one jot of color unto the weary and all-watched night, but freshly looks, and overbears a taint, with cheerful semblance and sweet majesty, that every wretch, pining and pale before, beholding him, plucks comfort from his looks. A largest universal like the sun, his liberal eye doth to give to everyone, thawing cold fear, that mean and gentle all behold as may unworthiness define, a little touch of Harry in the night. And then we get it dramatized for us with this difference. He does not go out as the king. He goes out in disguise as a simple soldier. We're back, if you will, in the tavern world where the prince is descending among the commoners and being as if he is a commoner with them. And that's when the debate with Williams takes place. You can read it on your own. It's fascinating. It's the question of who bears responsibility in sending a soldier into battle. It's a very real debate. It's a very good one. And Henry claims that they're expecting too much of the king, and what Henry insists on is that the king is a man as other men. Though I speak unto you, I think the king is but a man, as I am. The violet smells to him as it doth to me. The element shows to him as it doth to me. All his senses have but human conditions. His ceremonies laid by, in his nakedness he appears but a man. And though his affections are higher mounted than ours, yet when they stoop with the like wing. And maybe by mounting higher, he may have farther to fall. We have echoes of Richard, who discovers that you may be a king, but you're still a man. And Henry has learned this lesson. And even the notion of mounting upward, Richard's last lines, mount, mount, my soul. But what Henry is insisting on is that the king can fall like anyone else. And when he falls as all human beings fall. And then comes the great speech, the burden. Upon the king, let us our lives, our souls, our debts, our careful wives, our children, and our sins lay on the king. The burden of leadership, which he's well aware of. The trouble of sleep the night before this battle. And then, very important moment that proves what the Archbishop of Canterbury said earlier is correct. He kneels in prayer. And before we see him make the Crispin's Day speech and lead his men at the Battle of Agincourt, we hear him pray. O God of battles, steal my soldiers' hearts. Possess them not with fear. Take from them now the sense of reckoning or the opposed numbers, pluck their hearts from them. Not today, O Lord, O not today, think not upon the fault my father made encompassing the crown. The sins of the fathers are visited on the sons, and he knows it. And he is carrying a burden for what his father did. I, Richard's body, have interred new. Historically correct. Henry V had Richard's body dug up and buried with honors in London. True. And on it have bestowed more contrite tears than from it issued forced drops of blood. 500 poor I have in yearly pay, who twice a day their withered hands hold up toward heaven to pardon blood. This was true. Henry paid the poor to pray for Richard's soul. And I have built 2 chantries where the sad and solemn priests still sing for Richard's soul. That is historically accurate. More will I do, though all that I can do is nothing worth, since that my penitence comes after all, imploring pardon. My penitence. He is doing penance for the sins of his father. There's greatness in this man. There's greatness in this man. And then they're called off to the battle and we get the great speech. I want to look at a couple things in it. I could go through it line by line. You all know the speech. I want to point out a couple of things. I've already mentioned the beginning of it where the voice of Hotspur issues from him to rouse the troops, to talk about the greatness of honor. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. Please notice the first thing he does on this day is remind his troops of whose feast day it is. It was October 25th. Okay? He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named, and rouse him at the name of Crispian, not Agincourt, not Henry, Crispian. He that shall see this day and live old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is Saint Crispian. What will the result be? The result will be charity. Charity. Bring the neighbors in. Now we're celebrating the battle. We're remembering what went on. We're remembering the feast day. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. What is he doing as he feasts his neighbors, showing his wounds? Showing his wounds. The sacrifices he made fighting for his king and country. By the way, I need to point out something here. There is no mention in this speech of victory. Henry never says we're going to go and win. Henry says you're going to go in and fight, and if you get through it and go home, you'll be proud on this day. What, proud of what? That you fought. That you sacrificed. He never implies they're necessarily going to win. They were hugely outnumbered. Hugely outnumbered. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot. But he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. I love it. Especially with advantages. When my dear departed father would tell World War II stories, every time you heard them, it was like Falstaff talking about the Gad's Hill Rock. They'd be a little bit bigger. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages. Henry knows human nature. It's like that big fish that you caught years ago. That fish gets bigger and bigger every time you remember it. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. Please notice the imagery in here. We've got the scars, we've got the wine, we've got the flowing cups. It's secular, but there's a sense of something binding these people together. This story shall the good man teach his son. What does it mean to be a good man? You teach your son your country, his country's history. You pass maybe the first instance of homeschooling. The good man teaches his son the history of the nation and its battles. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. The feast of Saint Crispian honors two brothers who were martyred together on the same day in 286 in the persecution of Diocletian. It's not one martyr, it's two martyrs. Which explains the beauty of the line, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. It goes back to the saints. It goes back to their feast day. The two brothers. Be he ne'er so vile this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. Wow! Well, I'd go. Who wouldn't go? It's the greatest rabble-rousing military speech ever written. It's just stupendous. But the point I want to make, it is rooted in the feast day. That then becomes, as time goes on, a larger feast, and there is no guarantee of victory. What is there is the fact you fought. That's what's important. I got to say one other thing. I'm going to take the time, because I want to do this. Father recited this speech outside just a few minutes ago. He learned it a while ago. It's wonderful. Get him to do it for you. It's very good. I won't put him on the spot now. That's not fair. When I made my students memorize, I never made them do it in public. They could do it one-on-one in private. But many of them would memorize this speech, needless to say. I was teaching at a military academy. But always they got a line wrong. And Father, you got a line wrong. I'm going to correct you in public. I saved it for now for this reason. It's a little poetic thing. And everyone I know who memorizes the line, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered, they say. It doesn't have enough syllables. It's iambic pentameter, but we in it shall be remembered. And you've got to pronounce the ED at the end of the line to get the full foot. And what he's talking about is, as time stretches on, the memory will not be dropped or lost. And he does it by forcing the speaker of the line to pronounce the extra syllable to extend the line outward. That Shakespeare was just a genius. Oh, man, was he good. Oh, was he good. And little details like that are just breathtaking. They go into the battle and they whop the French. As you know, what am I telling you for? Great military victory based on, not numbers, but the longbow, the weaponry they had, where Henry placed the troops, the fact that the French were heavily armored and riding on horses and couldn't move, and when they fell off, couldn't get up, the field conditions, which were very muddy, and they got, by the way, in Orson Welles' film, you see that he uses it. The mud is everywhere. He shifts it to the Battle of Shrewsbury, and then, Kenneth Branagh puts it in his Henry V film, and then Mel Gibson steals it for Braveheart. Soldiers falling in the mud. It comes from Agincourt. That's what happened. Now, Shakespeare at this point deflates Henry again, takes away from him. It is historically true that he gave an order to have all the French prisoners killed. In the Chronicles, he does that when he learns that the French have murdered the boys who were guarding the luggage, including Falstaff's page boy. Shakespeare has the order given before the boys are killed, meaning Henry, out of nowhere, has the savage rise up in him and says, kill the prisoners. In the midst of the great battle, then he learns that the boys have been killed. And indeed, what happens? He gives the same order a second time. Kill the prisoners, before and after. It's not his finest moment. In the midst of the battle, he becomes the savage that earlier he said should just be imitated. It is a fact of war. We know it happens. Men can suddenly have that rise up in them and do things and behave in ways that otherwise they would not. It wasn't necessary because they win anyway. The numbers are staggering. 7,000 French dead, over 7,000 French dead, only 500 English. That's historical. That is staggering. Many of the French royalty were killed, only 2 English noblemen. Shakespeare writes a phony scene where they die together embracing each other. It's very touching. In fact, one of them was a great fat man who fell off his horse and his horse fell on him. No nobility there, but he doesn't use it. He makes it a rather more powerful scene. Henry reads the list of those who were lost and says, O God, thy arm was here, and not to us, but to thy arm alone ascribe we all. When without stratagem, but in plain shock and even play of battle, is ever known so great and little loss on one part and on the other, take it, God, for it is none but thine. Come, we go in procession to the village, and be it death proclaimeth through our host to boast of this. We won. We're not going to be pompous and boast about it. Or take that praise from God, which is only His. Do we all holy rites, let there be sung non nobis and te deum, the dead with charity enclosed in clay, and then to Calais and to England, then when ne'er from France arrived more happy men. It's a great victory. It does reach up towards something remarkable, one of the great battles in military history. Questionable beginnings. In the midst of it, Henry behaves savagely for no particular reason. This is messy and human stuff. But Shakespeare will still call him the mirror of all Christian kings. And in Act 5, the peace treaty is signed with the French. Under duress, the French don't have much choice. And the play ends with the great wooing scene of the Princess Catherine. If the play thus far has touched on the epic, we end this whole cycle in a comic scene. A young man wooing a young woman. And they don't speak the same language, which makes it even funnier. And we again have a moment when Henry descends. He speaks splendid poetry through the play. This whole scene, he's speaking prose. We have a man wooing a woman. We have a young guy who's hoping to win the heart of a young woman. Okay? Well, just a little touch of it. Just a little touch of it. A good heart, Kate, is the sun and the moon, or rather the sun and not the moon, for it shines bright and never changes, but keeps his course truly. If thou would have such a one, take me, and take me, take a soldier. Take a soldier, take a king. And what sayest thou then to my love? Speak, my fair, and fairly I pray thee. It's common speech. It's lovely. As I said, I always made my students memorize. They had to come in. They got to choose what they wanted to recite. I had a football player. Great lug of a guy. Huge guy. Built like me, only muscular. Okay. This size, but he was an athlete. Okay. He came in. He sat down. And I said, well, what are you going to recite? He said, well, I'm doing that wooing scene from the end of Henry V. I said, that's pages long. I said, that's very, are you doing a part? No, I learned the whole thing. I said, the whole thing? Yeah. Why'd you learn the whole thing? He said, well, I'm proposing to my girlfriend this weekend. And I didn't know what to say. So I thought, well, I'll learn this and then I'll use Shakespeare. And he can say it for me. I bit through my lip. I said, well, then let's go through it. He said, will you correct me? I said, sure, I'll correct you. He had memorized the whole thing. And he's reciting it. I made a few corrections. If thou would have such one, take me. And take me, take a soldier. Take a soldier, take a king. And what sayest thou then to my love? I'm dying. I said, it's fine, it's very good. I said, but you got to promise me one thing. He said, what's that? I said, you come in Monday morning and tell me what happened. He said, sure. So I'm in my office Monday morning, and he comes lumbering in and sits down, and I said, well, did it work? He said, I don't know. I said, what do you mean? Didn't you go through it? He said, yeah, I went through the whole thing. I remembered it all. I went through the whole thing. I said, what did she say? He said, nothing. I said, nothing? Why didn't she say anything? He said, she couldn't stop crying. She cried so hard I had to take her home. She didn't say another word all night. I said, that's a yes. And sure enough it was, and they are happily married now. It's a comedy. It's a comedy. And as in all comedy, comedy ends in compromise and healing. That marriage is a sign of renewal, regeneration, hope for the future, and that's how this whole cycle ends. But it's more than just the marriage of the young man and the young woman, the young king and the young princess. The Queen of France makes a lovely speech. God, the best maker of all marriages, combine your hearts in one. your realms in one. It's a marriage of two realms. As man and wife being two are one in love, so be there twixt your kingdom such a spousal that never may ill office or fell jealousy, which troubles off the bed of blessed marriage, thrust in between the paction of these kingdoms to make divorce of their incorporate league, that English may as French, French Englishmen receive each other. God speak this, amen, and everyone says amen, and the cycle is over, except we get an epilogue from the chorus. It's a sonnet. Enter chorus. And this is the end of this whole historical sweep we've watched. Thus far with rough and all unable pen. Please notice the playwright's putting himself down now. This really wasn't very good, which continues part of the theme of the play. We're trying, we're aspiring, we're hoping to do our best, but Shakespeare speaks of himself thus far with rough and all unable pen. Our bending author hath pursued the story. In little room, confining mighty men, mangling by starts the full course of their glory. Small time. But in that small, most greatly lived this star of England. Fortune made his sword, by which the world's best garden he achieved, friends. And of it left his son imperial lord, Henry VI, in infant bands crowned king of France and England, did this king succeed, whose state so many had the managing, that they lost France and made his England bleed, which oft our stage hath shown. And for their sake, in your fair minds, let this acceptance take. We went through all this. We have a happy ending, and the playwright reminds us, history is time. Time is messy. England goes back to fight in France and loses. England erupts in more civil war. And time goes on creating more history, overseen by fallen men, hoping to do their best, mangling the world, occasionally saving their souls, filled with honor and love and death and betrayal, which is what great drama is all about, and there are few greater dramas than these plays penned by your own Master Shakespeare. Thank you very much.
Take questions if you got any, or... You probably had enough.
Yes.
Point that you came out, I didn't realize. You mentioned the whole thing is almost unprecedented, didn't you?
Yes.
The point is, in England then, the feast days of the saints have been suppressed.
Oh, absolutely they had been. Of course. It's a very good point. When that speech is made at the Globe, the feast days had been suppressed. So what you have here, again, it's one of those things where it's just... they denied this for centuries. Oh, Shakespeare had no religious beliefs. I mean, nonsense. The whole basis of it's called the St. Crispin's Day speech for a reason. Absolutely. There he is. He's asserting it from the stage. They weren't celebrating those feast days anymore. Of course not. Of course not. And becomes the focus of the whole thing. Yes. Absolutely. And it suggests, please notice, this story shall the good man teach his son. That may be a tip of the hat to Shakespeare's father, who was a devout Catholic, and taught him not just about Agincourt, but that was fought on St. Crispin's Day. Yeah, it could well be a tip of the hat to his own father. That may be how he learned about it. That had never occurred to me till you asked the question. Yes, no, exactly. Exactly. It's beautiful. It's extremely... To me, it makes the speech that much more moving. That much more moving, yeah. It's... By the way, I was talking earlier. I mentioned yesterday the phoenix and the turtle. The last line, I was going over it with someone earlier. The last line is, for these two birds sigh a prayer. We're at the funeral urn. And the last thing in the poem is, for these two birds sigh a prayer. Pray for the dead. That had been strictly forbidden at that time. He prints it in 1601. That was strictly forbidden. There's another example. That's about as forthright as he got. He was not a public Catholic. But anybody who reads that or hears that would know what was going on. Pray for the dead. Pray for the dead, he's saying.
Also, in the epilogue to the Tempest.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Oh. Now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. Now 'tis true I must be here confined by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got, and pardoned the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell, but release me from my bands with the help of your good hands. Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please. Now I want art to enforce, spirits to enchant, and my ending is despair, unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardon be, let your indulgence set me free. Last line he ever wrote. I mean, just bonk. Goodbye, London. And he went back to Stratford. Last line he ever wrote, the word indulgence. Just sort of, you know, boom. I love it. It's magnificent. But also, you'll notice, the last lines he wrote, as you from crimes would pardon be, forgive us our trespasses, is it's the Lord's Prayer. He ends with a clear reference to the Lord's Prayer. But he had no religious belief. Scholars have told us for centuries he wasn't a religious man. He didn't care about religion. Poor, poor blind souls. Poor, poor blind souls.
What do you think on that note? What do you think of your theories about Shakespeare's biography of Shakespeare? You know, all of my students tell me all kinds of things that are going between what they are about his lifestyle, what he's up to.
Oh, absolutely. So all lies. It's all lies. It's all lies. What's so sad? My students would come into the Shakespeare course, and the first two questions, did he really write the plays? Was he gay? That's all they've learned about Shakespeare. Those two things you can count on them knowing, both obvious lies. Again, I don't want to go through this whole thing again, but the authorship business didn't begin until the latter part of the 18th century, early 19th century, in America, God forgive us. Crazy woman named Delia Bacon, who was convinced her ancestor, Sir Francis Bacon, he wasn't, she made that up, had actually written the plays. Proof of it was buried there in the grave in Stratford at Trinity Church. That's why she said the curse was on the grave. Good friend, for Jesus' sake, forbear to dig the dust and close it here. Blessed be the man who spares these stones, but cursed be he who moves my bones. Grave's never been opened. Well, Delia was going to open it. She went to Stratford and tried to get permission to dig up the grave. They said, no, you're not digging up the grave. So she got a shovel and a pickaxe and broke into the church at night and was about to dig up the grave when she was arrested. That's the beginning of the authorship debate, okay? And it's gotten wackier since then. Because then it was just Sir Francis Bacon. Now it's Christopher Marlowe and Queen Elizabeth, and the current favorite candidate is the Earl of Oxford, who died years before Shakespeare retired from the stage. And it's very curious that he then, from beyond the grave, could write plays that refer to events that happened after his death. And it's also very curious that Oxford wrote poetry and published it under his own name that stinks. But when he wrote under a pseudonym, he was suddenly a genius. No, they're crazy. And as for the whole gay thing, the modern world cannot think above the belt. Nothing exists above the belt. So that the fact that there was real love between Shakespeare and the young nobleman, and he speaks of it in terms of love, which means a high platonic friendship, and an incredible closeness, for the modern mind has to mean they were rutting like crazed weasels. It's just nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. And in fact, he makes a joke about it in sonnet number 20. If you want the refutation, read sonnet number 20, which is uproariously funny. The young nobleman apparently had Henry Risley, Earl of Southampton. Had to be. The young man had very feminine features. Very feminine features. And the sonnet is about how the young man originally was to be made as a woman by nature. So Mother Nature is making this woman, who's so beautiful, Mother Nature falls in love with this woman she's making and decides to, since Mother Nature is a woman, make it a man at the last minute. Okay? By adding one thing, Shakespeare says, to my purpose nothing. So when Mother Nature added that one thing at that point, then, you know, there'd never be anything of that nature between us. But since she hath pricked thee out for women's pleasure, there's thine be my love and thy love's use their treasure. So I love you, but when it comes time for the physical parts of love, then you go to the ladies. It's very funny. He addresses it openly. It's in sonnet number 20. He can joke about it.
And when my mistress died, not about the son, about it, it wasn't that he had a mistress. It was just he was writing from the point of view of just he was imagining that.
You know, I'll be quite honest. I think he did have a mistress. This is personal opinion. Can't be proven. No, can't be proven. I'll tell you why I believe it. Those poems show such guilt. He was racked with guilt. Sonnet 129, which is the greatest thing ever written on lust. I would hammer my students with this. The expense of spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action. And till action, lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust. Enjoyed no sooner but despised straight. Past reason hunted and no sooner had, past reason hated as a swallowed bait on purpose laid to make the taker mad. Mad in pursuit and in possession so. Had, having, and in quest to have extreme. A bliss in proof and proved of very woe. Before a joy proposed, behind a dream. All this the world well knows, yet none knows well to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell. That seems to me experiential. That's somebody, I think, who was caught in the snares of a daughter of Eve. And was just, but that's personal opinion. We don't know. But I think that explosion of guilt shows a very healthy conscience. A very healthy conscience. So, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, from that moment on in the plays, there are all these characters. And he knew something about the conscience and what guilt produces. Yeah. Yeah, very much so. He was very human. What he didn't experience, he could imagine fully. What is there in the world that this man somehow didn't encompass, understand, and set down? Just amazing. Just amazing. And he's yours. You should feel very, very proud. Very proud. He belongs to, as the great Ben Jonson says, he was not of an age, but for all time. So I would say he was not for a country, but for all the world. Yeah, for all the world as well. Thank you very much. Thank you.